From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when a Republican presidential candidate called for an income tax cut of 15 percentage points. That candidate said that cutting taxes for everyone, particularly the highest earners, would spark economic growth. That candidate promised that cutting taxes at the top would allow wealth to trickle down to those at the bottom. Supporters call it supply-side economics. Opponents have lampooned it for years as trickle-down. Who was the candidate in question? In this case, we're talking about 1996, Bob Dole. And that proposal sparked a debate about whether the Reagan years had proven that supply-side economics work or whether it concentrated wealth at the top while ballooning the debt and deficit. Fast forward 20 years. Donald Trump's on the verge of winning the Republican nomination. He is proposing massive tax cuts while promising it won't grow the deficit. But many Republican leaders are saying something interesting and almost contradictory. They're saying that working-class conservatives have figured out the game. They figured out that it doesn't trickle down and the working class gets left out. So why are they supporting Donald Trump? Well, one big reason might be trade. Trump is the most strident opponent of trade deals in the race. He said he doesn't mind a trade war under the current terms, and he promises workers he will level the field, make it fair, and bring jobs back. This hour, we've asked two guests to come in and address a couple of issues. Is this the end of supply-side economics if the conservative working class no longer believes in it? And what should we know about trade deals that are so often discussed but not with much depth in the presidential campaign? Let me welcome my guests. Amit Banabiyal is a professor of economics at RIT. And Amit, nice to have you back.
Thank you, Evan, for having me.
And Kent Gardner is the chief economist with the Center for Governmental Research in Rochester and a principal. Nice to have you back as well, Kent.
Nice to be here, Evan.
Well, let me just start, I guess, with taxes, because we'll do taxes and we'll do trade. And in many ways, this will be like an Econ 101 class working back through, because Kent, you were just saying, you know, there's plenty of people out there who maybe took a couple credits in economics, and
yeah, not enough of them, unfortunately.
Yeah, right. Or maybe half a credit and feel empowered to
precisely,
to weigh in.
Right.
But yeah. Look, I mean, I understand some of the emotion at play that we're seeing among working class voters in this election, and when it comes to tax cuts, I want to listen to Donald Trump first of all. Here's Donald Trump talking about his desire to cut taxes. I think we've got that. We'll get it in just a second here. Analysts have said, by the way, that Trump's plan would be largely concentrated at the top of the earnings scale. And Trump himself has said it's going to spark growth, won't grow the deficit. And so Trump's said that many times in debates on the campaign trail. He hasn't been all that specific in terms of white papers and policy positions, et cetera. But Val, it's 06163 if you want to grab it. It's in there somewhere. We'll get it in just a second. What about this idea, guys, of an idea that right now with where the rates are, that if we cut taxes, we should automatically assume growth? Amit?
I think it's basically a nonsensical idea. There's little evidence for it. And everything we know about its intellectual precursor, supply-side economics, pioneered by Ronald Reagan and his advisors, Art Laffer and company, there is really little, if any, trickle-down. Moreover, the idea that supply-side economics, that is based on a particular shape of the so-called individual hours supplied in terms of labor as a function of the tax. No one really knows what it actually looks like. And even if it does look the way supply-siders claim it looks, it's very difficult for the government to get the precise tax right so that there will, in fact, be economic growth of the sort that you actually see. So the empirical evidence is scant, if any.
All right. And I know some listeners are going to say, well, now it's becoming an ideological conversation. Not exactly so. You're about to hear some voices in this conversation who you would not say are anything but conservative, and you're going to hear their concerns with supply side. But let's listen to what Donald Trump says about tax cuts, and we'll get Kent's take.
It will provide major tax relief for middle income and for most other Americans. There will be a major tax reduction. It'll simplify the tax code. It'll grow the American economy at a level that it hasn't seen for decades. And all of this does not add to our debt or our deficit.
Kent, does not add to the debt or deficit.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, you force us to start this by listening to Donald Trump, Evan.
But hold on. That's fair. But I also just want to say, and I've been saying it in recent days, I am absolutely trying very earnestly to understand the level of his support, the what has motivated the support, and in many ways, I'm hearing from a lot of people who analyze the race, the fields, etc., working class conservatives are gravitating towards certain economic messages. So, and there are millions of them right now. So
yeah, that's true. Fair. Yeah, so I guess the issue about cutting taxes depends in. I think very much on how taxes really are. And to the extent that we were looking, if you go back to the Reagan years, we were looking at a marginal tax rate that was well above 50%.
Right.
And I think that what happens when you've got a marginal tax rate that is that high is that people who have income spend a lot of their time and effort, they spend significant sums trying to figure out how to hide income that would otherwise be taxable. It just diverts the investments they might make from one kind of productive area to a less productive area. So inevitably, when taxes are very, very high, it distorts people's decision making. And one of the kind of basic fundamentals in economics is that that by and large, productive investment goes in productive directions, provided it isn't diverted by odd things like very, very high marginal tax rates. So I think that the proposition that when tax rates are very high, that reducing those tax rates can redirect investment in ways that are probably more productive for the economy. And if they're more productive for the economy, it's a reasonable proposition that the entire economy will benefit from that. Now, this notion of it trickling down, I think, is entirely too simplistic. And this whole notion of even calling a supply-side economics is too simplistic. It's a very, you know, the macroeconomy is a very complex place. And you know, how we influence it is something we've been trying to figure out for a very long time. So, you know, I think that the argument that with tax rates where they are right now, that you can cut tax rates, increase economic activity, and therefore increase tax revenue sufficiently that the tax cut is offset is just nonsensical.
Okay, well, I want to read the comments from Bruce Bartlett, and then we're going to listen to some comments from another prominent conservative about supply side. This is Bruce Bartlett, who was part of Ronald Reagan's economic team. He wrote a scathing critique of modern conservative ideology on taxes in the New York Times, and here is part of that. He writes, quote, "As one who was present at the creation of supply-side economics back in the 70s, I think it is long past time that the phrase be put to rest. It did its job creating a new consensus among economists on how to look at the national economy. But today, it has become a frequently misleading and meaningless buzzword that gets in the way of good economic policy. Today, supply-side economics has become associated with an obsession for cutting taxes under any and all circumstances. No longer do its advocates in Congress and elsewhere confine themselves to cutting marginal tax rates, the tax on each additional dollar earned, as the original supply-siders did. Rather, they support even the most gimmicky, economically dubious tax cuts with the same intensity. The original supply-siders suggested that some tax cuts, under very special circumstances, might actually raise federal revenues. For example, cutting the capital gains tax rate might induce an unlocking effect that would cause more gains to be realized, thus causing more taxes to be paid on such gains, even at a lower rate. But today it is common to hear tax cutters claim, implausibly, that all tax cuts raise revenue. This is a simplification of what supply-side economics was all about, and it threatens to undermine the enormous gains that have been made in economic theory and policy over the last 30 years. Perhaps the best way of preventing that from happening is to kill the phrase supply-side economics and give it a decent burial." End quote. Amit, what do you think?
I think that's probably a good idea. I mean, in the intellectual circles that I typically move in, and the you know, the work that I typically read pays scant attention to supply side economics. It was a largely discredited idea. The only thing that I will say in support of it, as somebody who does theoretical research, is theoretically, just from a theoretical perspective, it's an interesting idea. That, for instance, if I were to, you know, lower tax rates, for instance, on income or labor, that the hours supplied would increase, and that would have a positive effect on the economy. At the level of theory, that's an interesting idea. But the question is there data to support the fact that this is the kind of behavior that you would actually see? And the answer is very no, absolutely not. The other big idea associated with supply-side economics, and I think your readers will be, listeners, excuse me, will be able to grasp this very easily, is to simply draw an inverted U, okay? When you draw an inverted U, the idea is on the horizontal axis, as I keep increasing taxes, tax collections rise, they max out at some level, and then they fall.
So Art Laffer and company believe that we are to the right of the hump. That is, we are way ahead of ourselves in terms of the tax rates that are currently applicable. So if only we were to reduce the tax rate, we would get closer to the hump than we would maximize tax collections. And that's one key idea of supply-side economics. But again, are we there? The empirical evidence doesn't suggest that that's in fact the case. So even though it's a theoretically interesting idea, the evidence from the last 30 or 40 years has shown that empirically there is little justification for it.
But I mean, if the tax rate were 98%,
right,
and you cut it to 78%, then the idea is it could actually spark growth.
I cannot answer that question definitively without knowing what the function linking tax receipts to tax rates actually looks like. So what you're saying may be true, but it may not be. We need empirical information about that relationship, which is very difficult to come by. And itself, it's a dynamic relationship, changing over time.
Okay. Kent?
Well, I think it really is a little simpler than that. I mean, I think that when tax rates are very high, they change behavior. And that's really the issue that we're confronting here. Does it change behavior in productive or unproductive ways? And I believe at some point it's not just theory. I mean, come on, demonstrated. And I think if you take a look at the stimulus we saw after the 1964 tax cut, which was a Kennedy idea, not a Republican idea, and certainly the economy did respond to a reduction in tax rates after the Reagan tax cuts. So, I think that the notion that there's a connection between marginal tax rates and behavior has been validated, actually. I think fast forward to now, I mean, there's absolutely no argument now that one could reduce tax rates and therefore increase total federal revenue. That's just completely nonsensical.
All right, so that inverted U, you do not think Laffer is right on where we currently are in relation to it?
I don't know what Laffer is talking about these days. Where we are right now, if we reduce tax rates, we reduce revenue.
Yeah, okay.
A statement like that means something about where you are on the Laffer curve. That means you're not where he claims he was.
Understood. Now, I see the phone starting to ring. If you want to call the program with questions or comments, 844-295-TALK. There will not be a quiz. 844-295-8. Well, last time I
was... Oh, I've got one, Evan. I've got one
for
you. Yes, right. Oh. As soon as we're done here.
Okay. Last time I was here, we did have a quiz. Not today. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. I want to listen to, and I know if you listen to this program every day, you might have heard the soundbite a couple of weeks ago, but I think it bears playing again because this is a former congressman who was part of when Newt Gingrich was leading Congress and they did the contract with America, et cetera. Joe Scarborough was in Congress, and now, of course, he hosts a program on MSNBC with Mika Brzezinski called Morning Joe. And Joe is a conservative who had this to say. I want to listen to what Joe Scarborough said about trickle-down economics and conservative working-class voters.
The problem with the Republican Party over the past 30 years is they haven't, and I'll say we haven't, developed a message that appeals to the working-class Americans economically in a way that how Donald Trump's does. I mean, you look at the fact we talk about cutting capital gains taxes. That 10,000 people that are in the crowd cheering for Donald Trump, they are never going to get a capital gains cut because it doesn't apply. We talk about getting rid of the death tax. The death tax is not going to impact the 10,000 people in the crowd for Donald Trump. The Republicans said, okay, listen, we're going to have all of these trade deals and tax cuts that benefit our wealthiest donor class, but we'll give them the social issues. We'll give them abortion.
Right.
We'll give them gay marriage. We'll give them guns, and they'll vote for us. What we're finding this year is they'll even support a guy who says Planned Parenthood is good if he comes with an economic approach that they feel could actually help them more in the future.
Joe Scarborough says working class conservatives have realized it never trickles down. Is that a fair analysis? Do you think of where the electorate is and maybe that we're seeing in the primaries, Kent?
Well, let's do two things. First, the question of, the empirical question of whether it never trickles down, I mean, brings in a whole collection of questions that I don't think we've got time to address. So I don't want to talk to that specifically. But
he's saying working class conservatives feel scammed on the whole idea.
Yeah, but I think that the notion that working class conservatives have recognized that tax cuts don't benefit them is a really valid and accurate statement. You know, I think that there's but what makes this very complicated is that, you said we want to talk about trade later.
Yep.
I think that globalization, but not just globalization, but what is deeply embedded in globalization, which is technological change, mm-hmm. technological mm-hmm. change, globalization, a lot of other factors driving costs in America certainly have made things worse for basic middle class voters and certainly for people in blue collar occupations.
Okay, Ahmed?
I would basically agree with many of the statements that are made. And I think this is one of the few senses in which Donald Trump's presence is a positive thing for the American voter and certainly Republican voters, because he is pointing very clearly to some of the key economic anxieties that large segments of the American population, particularly those who have had anything to do with manufacturing, feel now in terms of how their lives have evolved or not evolved, as the case may be, in the past 30 years. And this disconnect between the Republican elite and the grassroots Republican workers is something that he's exploiting very skillfully.
All right, let me get our first phone call. And Keith, first up, go ahead, Keith.
I have an interesting show. You constantly have these politicians who go on and on and on about cutting corporate tax, but I believe I read a statistic once that only about 20% of the corporations in this country actually pay a tax. I mean, if cutting the corporate tax is good, well, wouldn't you take that logic and saying eliminate all corporate tax would be fantastic?
Hey, Keith, you know, I think the conversation about corporate taxes is an interesting one. One of the reasons for that is that corporate profits flow to the people who own stock. And so corporate taxes arguably are taxed. Corporate profits are taxed twice. Right now, we have a problem that is one that we might actually want to fix, which is that because our corporate tax rates are very high, a lot of corporations are parking a fabulous amount of money overseas because they don't want to recognize those profits in the United States because of the rate of taxation. That's a frustration that's imposed by the globalization of the economy. And it also is one of the things that's spurring these many inversions we see. So, you know, it gets really, really messy. So I don't know that it's easy to tax corporations. Despite Citizens United, corporations aren't people. Ultimately, the profits of corporations flow to individual tax rates.
Ken, what would be the I own a corporation, and the last 2 years, I actually paid my first corporate tax in about 35 years last year, only because I had money in my checking account to pay bills that were due in January. And my accountant said, well, why didn't you post-date the check? Well, I went ahead and paid the tax. But, I mean, what do you do? Do you say, okay, no matter, how do you determine if a company makes a profit? I mean, it's so convoluted, and there's no simple answer.
No, that's for sure. And convoluted is the best way to describe our tax system. Our tax system is dramatically way too complicated, and I think that the tax simplification is something that I think most economists can get around.
Well, let's talk a little bit about trade, because that's been the other thing that has really driven a lot of the working class conservative support of Donald Trump. And he talks often about trade, unabashedly, aggressively about trade. Here he is in a recent CNN debate talking about trade and why he is not afraid to oppose the deals. Let's listen to Trump.
Well, you know, I don't mind trade wars when we're losing $58 billion a year. You want to know the truth? We're losing so much. We're losing so much with Mexico and China. China, we're losing $500 billion a year. And then people say, oh, don't we want to trade? I don't mind trading, but I don't want to lose $500 billion. I don't want to lose $58 billion. Mexico just took Carrier Corporation, maker of air conditioners. They just took Ford. They're building a $2.5 billion plant. They just took Nabisco out of Chicago. And I always say I'm not having Oreos anymore, which is true, by the way. But they just took a big plant from Nabisco into Mexico. They're taking our businesses. I don't mind.
Okay. So he says he's not afraid of a trade war under the current terms here. And that has appealed to a lot of people. Amit Badabian?
The problem here is no one has adequately explained to the American population in general why free trade is advantageous to a particular country. And the argument is nuanced, and we can have a discussion about that if you want. But if that argument is made in a clear fashion to Americans, then they will understand the sense in which free trade benefits.
Well, right now, free trade is losing the PR war.
Yes, and there are several reasons for that. And the simplest reason is, well, let me backtrack a little. Every trade model that I'm aware of makes a very simple prediction about the effects of trade. Folks working in the export sectors of an economy generally benefit. Those competing with imports generally lose. So if some folks benefit and others lose, the question is, what happens to the country as a whole? And the argument that economists typically make is that the winners win by more than the losers lose. And it's in that sense that free trade is overall desirable to consumers or the population in general. But the problem is the people who lose big time often, and we offer very little actual tangible assistance to the people who lose, many of whom happen to be located in the manufacturing sector of the United States. And these people who are hurting big time are not only receiving little or no aid, it's very difficult for a lot of them to, retool and move to some other sector without any kind of assistance. And this gets particularly difficult as you advance in age. So the anxiety associated with job loss, hours reduction, while seeing other countries handsomely profit, and a favorite whipping boy of many of our politicians is China, is a key source of this anxiety. So the argument needs to be made very, very precisely, and the sense in which free trade is good.
Kent Gardner?
I think that's a good explanation of what's going on, and that becomes a challenge I think we confront in lots of public policy areas, is that, you know, we have something that we think is good for all, but it may not be good for one. And it's inevitable that the changes like this, and trade's just a great example, it can be a good idea in general, but if we don't have a process by which we can help the people who are disproportionately hurt by that, then it can create some really serious dislocations for individuals. I don't really know a way out of the box. The response of the people who are opposed to trade is to say, well, let's just, either it's Donald Trump who says, well, what we want to do is we want to make sure that any kind of a trade deal that we disproportionately win, and we're all going to win from trade deals. We're only going to engage in those trade deals for which we end up being the winners. And as a consequence of that, I mean, I think a lot of countries will say, well, that's fine. We won't trade with you, as trade really has to be a two-way street between nations. But figuring out how you open yourselves to trade it's really impossible to open yourselves to trade without there being some people who lose. And I think that's a problem we've had forever.
Okay, but right now, a lot of workers are hearing a message that says what Kent and Amit just said describes the world when Kodak was rocking and rolling and the big three were here and and by the way, I know there's all kinds of comments about the state of manufacturing. Dan Dresner of the Washington Post linked to a study recently that showed we're actually making more things in this country than we ever have. We're just employing fewer people to do it than we did 20 years ago for a lot of reasons, more automation, different things. And we can get into that. But the message I think people are feeling, and yes, some of it from Donald Trump, some of it from others, is that right now the deals are so bad because there's no rules for the other guys, for China, for Mexico. They can pay their workers so little that companies have incentive to go there. And what happens is it's bad for the workers who live there because they don't get paid much, and it's bad for the workers in our country because they don't get a job at all. And, Ken, I know that's a simplification, but when you encounter that kind of sentiment?
Well, there's so many different pieces of that. First, let's talk about the workers in the other countries who are being injured because they're trading with the United States. I mean, I think that that's patently false, because people are being paid less than they're paid than the workers in the United States would have been paid otherwise. I mean, it's still more than they were making before. So, I mean, I think that by and large, trade deals do benefit workers in low-wage countries. We can't say because they're not being paid what we think is a fair wage that they're being injured.
But some workers live in poverty still, yeah?
And your solution to that is to stop trading with them entirely.
Well, again, I think part of the political policy prescription that at least is floated is you demand higher worker standards, et cetera.
And we have done that to a large degree. And I think that, you know, we've had some, some citizen-led, some consumer-led efforts to improve working conditions in many of the factories we deal with. Nike has been subject to some consumer actions that have forced them to be more responsible about how they manage the employees, the supply contracts they have in other countries. It is difficult. But I do think that the other question is whether everyone's conforming to the same rules, and we certainly do set up rules when we do trade deals. The TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, has a lot of rules associated with it. Parties on both sides negotiate what rules would appear to the negotiators to benefit both sides. These trade deals, we have people on our side who are not idiots. Who try to determine in collaboration with a lot of partners on our side of the trade deal, what would constitute a good and fair deal for the United States, and they negotiate the best deal they can get.
Can I add something to that? Another key aspect of this discussion, which is very easily lost, is the so-called benefits from free trade. A lot of people don't see any benefits, but it's important to remember that typically wearing our consumer hats, the benefits are of two kinds: increased variety of products and lower prices associated with the products that you see. But again, here's the problem. So for instance, if we free trade in sugar with a whole bunch of Caribbean countries, and as a result, the price of sugar goes down by a dime, okay, that's fine. Everybody likes lower prices. But no one's going to be marching to Washington, D.C. because 100,000 consumers, their price of sugar went down by a dime. Nobody does that because the benefits of trade are broadly diffused in the economy and they're felt by a very large part of the population. But the people in the import competing sectors who are adversely affected by trade, many of whom are in manufacturing, it's much easier for them to band together, coalesce around certain common causes, and claim with considerable justification that we are being hit real hard by trade. Our government is doing nothing about it. Our government is more concerned about free trade. We don't see any benefits from free trade. That dichotomy, the benefits being widely diffused in the economy, contrasted with the losses, which tend to be very specific and concentrated, is what makes the argument for free trade very difficult to comprehend for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's a wonderful point. It's a really important component of the kind of the political dynamic that drives these trade deals. And the fact that you pick up sugar, I don't know whether that was intentional, but sugar is interesting because we actually don't do a lot of trade in sugar because we have this small concentrated group of sugar producers who are very good at playing the political system to
make sure that we
have high tariffs on sugar to make sure that we aren't actually trading fairly on the world market in sugar. We really ought to be. It's criminal for us to be subsidizing sugar producers, a very small number of fairly well-off sugar producers in the United States, as opposed to sharing, trading with people who can produce sugar at a much lower cost down in tropical areas. I mean, sugar is a tropical, sugar cane is a tropical a crop. And we really should be trading with people who can grow it more productively than we can.
One of my favorite stories, we talked about it on the Freedom of Information discussion last week, was a 2006 CODEL, a congressional delegation, including Democrats and Republicans, Randy Kuhl, the Republican from the Southern Tier, Elliot Engel, Democrat from the New York City area. They wanted to go to Brazil to learn about their sugar ethanol, because I'm sure there are broad applications here. They just happened to take a riverboat cruise to Iguazu Falls in Brazil.
Ah, Iguazu Falls. Well, such a shame. I suppose it's right. Must be right near the sugar producing area.
I'm sure. Yeah.
I'm sure there's an ethanol plant right on the falls.
Yes.
Deep in the Amazon.
Bernard in Fairport. Next up. Go ahead, Bernard.
Yeah, I'd like to maybe change the theme of this conversation a little bit. It seems to me that the study and understanding of economics is really a secondary issue. What we really need to focus on and understand is how to create a good society and a good life. So, for example, I think one of the primary examples we have here in New York is General Electric is recognized, if you will, at least I think so, as a good company, well-run, et cetera, et cetera. But they poisoned a major river in New York, and they seem to be unwilling to pay to fix that, assuming they can fix it. So it seems to me that when you come to thinking about how you're going to create an economy or run an economy or deal with an economy, you really have to step back and say, is it going to make people happier, healthier, more education, a better life, rather than how much more percentage am I going to make this year? So, for example, is the United States the best country in the world measured by the life quality as opposed to a Denmark or a Finland or so forth? So it just seems to me that when we talk about economy, we really go down from what the major goal of our society needs to be. We're more interested in profit than we are in good lives. So I'd appreciate the comments of the economists on that. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Bernard.
Well, you know, I completely agree that economic values don't define quality of life. They don't define moral worth. They don't define what it means for a life to be well lived. You know, certainly, you know, someone who dies with a lot of money in his bank account is not a better person who dies without that. And I think as people come closer and closer to the end of their lives, they focus more on fundamental values that are a whole lot more than income. The challenge we have, I guess, is I don't see how, you know, it's very difficult, I guess, for us as a nation to focus on that together, and for a lot of people, acquiring the means to be able to feed their families and to take vacations and to buy some of the things that they think will make their lives better, that's the function of the economy. And you know, I think as economists, we try not to be judgmental about what constitutes a good life and what constitutes a worthy purchase.
Amit? At the level of principle, I think the caller is absolutely right, and I have no quibble with it. But 2 points. Firstly, we have to understand that the U.S. economy is fundamentally a free enterprise, entrepreneurial, capitalist system. And in this capitalist system, irrespective of whether you like it or not, the reason why firms exist is to maximize profits. That's their raison d'etre. They exist to maximize profits. And maximizing profits means doing everything you can to raise revenue and lower costs. Now, again, at the level of principle, that's not problematic, but the specific actions that firms actually undertake to raise revenue and lower costs is where a lot of the problems arise. So if you want to get away from a culture that emphasizes profits, money, greed, etc. Remember Gordon Gekko's line from Wall Street, greed is good. Well, that if you want to get away from that kind of sentiment, then we really have to fundamentally rethink what societal values we do and don't want to promote. The caller mentioned Denmark. Denmark is one of four Scandinavian countries where the value system in terms of what constitutes the good life is quite different from the value system that we typically hold dear here in the United States. Taxes are much higher. It's a significantly more socialized economy than we have in the United States. Now, if we want to move in that direction, then we can. But then that involves a fundamental rethink of our entire value system. And that's something that we can certainly move in the direction of, but it's going to take time. It's not anything that you can do in, you know, 1 or 2 years, or certainly not 1 or 2 months.
Okay. And certainly leaders play a role in that. I mean, you know, we see Bernie Sanders, I think, making that argument.
Yeah.
And he is making an appeal to fundamentally change how we think about society in America. And, you know, some people are very excited by, you know, the arguments that Sanders is making. And, you know, if Sanders were to win this election, he would be empowered to make some of those changes and to force some of those changes, or at least put those some of those changes before Congress. It is essentially a democratic system. We do have the power, as Sanders reminds us. We do have the power to change those fundamental relationships. The one other point, just a factual point I'd like to make to the caller, is General Electric would be very surprised to hear that they have not spent any money to clean up the Hudson River. They have spent billions and billions of dollars taking PCBs out of the soils of the Hudson. And what's more, what's interesting about that is that there is actually a fair bit of evidence that suggests that they should have left them be. But that's a longer conversation, which we need to get into. But they have spent a fabulous amount of money, and that remediation process continues.
Our phones are lit up with questions from our listeners for our guests about free trade generally, but we're opening it up for the rest of the hour. So let's get a short break in. We're going to come back with Professor of Economics at RIT, Amit Badabial, and Kent Gardner, the Chief Economist with the Center for Governmental Research. Your phone calls next. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on the Next Connections, first hour, you might see some conflicting stories about solar in the news recently. Some conflicting reports on Solar City out of Buffalo, and also the launch of the new Solarize campaign in Rochester. So what do we need to know about the state of solar? That's first hour. Then second hour, a $15 minimum wage. Opponents and supporters talk about the possible impact in New York State. We'll talk with you Thursday.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Writers and Books, promoting reading and writing as lifelong activities with classes and other literary events for children and adults. Registration is open for spring classes and youth summer write camps. For a complete list of workshops and events, visit wab.org.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, doing their best to rehabilitate the image of free trade. Amit Badabial and Kent Gardner. Now, they've been saying that in many ways, if you're just joining us, free trade's been taking a beating in public relations because the benefits of free trade are often diffuse, whereas the occasional problems that arise, workers, lost jobs, are acute and more obvious.
Concentrated,
easily seen. So let's get your questions. This is Robert in Fairport. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, I think that the discussion is kind of really theoretical, has been really theoretical so far, and I think it's missed the big picture here. Since the Berlin Wall has come down, you probably had 2 to 3 billion new labor participants brought into world markets, and I think that some of the Trump voters you're talking about are in the class that are getting squeezed out by these new labor participants, and they don't have the demand for products for these new labor participants is nowhere near as high as it is as their effect of depressing global wages. And I think that's a big thing that needs to be considered.
You know, that's a very good point, and it's one I think that, can't be emphasized enough. If you take a look at what's happened, it's not simply the fall of the Iron Curtain. It's not simply the entrance of the Soviet Union and its satellites into the world market, but it's also increasing educational levels in China. It's China's entrance into the market more than anything else. It's the transformation of much of industry in India. It's the increase in communications technology that makes it possible for people to compete over the internet for service jobs. The level of the supply of work in the world economy has gone up in fabulous ways, and that has inevitably, regardless of how we think about the trade situation, has inevitably increased competition for American workers.
That's certainly true, and the one thing that I would add to that is that in addition to the mass influx of large numbers of people who were formerly not a significant participant in the global economy is the idea of skill-biased technological change. Mm-hmm. With globalization, that this is a key phenomena, which means the returns to labor are typically accruing to those who have the skills that the increasingly information and communication technology-based economy requires. So the people who are most likely to benefit from this globalized era that we live in are workers who have those skills, because the technological changes that are occurring are increasingly pro-skill biased. So people who don't have the skills, for whatever reason, are increasingly losing out. And it's just very, very difficult, for instance, in the United States today to get ahead without any kind of college education.
Well, just briefly, I recall 15 years ago, I was working in Charleston, West Virginia, the capital of West Virginia, and there was a big debate in the state about coal hauling. That was a big part of the industry. Obviously, the coal industry is big down there. And coal haulers were hauling 150,000 tons of coal, and infrastructure was taking a beating, and the state legislature was moving to limit the amount of coal that haulers could haul. And haulers were saying, we're not going to be able to afford it. And they stopped bumper to bumper and surrounded the state capitol and said, lawmakers are not going home until you fix this. And I recall interviewing a truck driver who said to me, I'm 50 years old. I don't have any other skills. This is putting me out of a job. What do they expect me to do? And I was really struck by that. And I had a conversation recently with a friend who still lives in Charleston who said, there is a mentality now that, you know, years ago when you graduated, maybe high school, maybe you didn't even finish high school, maybe you did, maybe you went to college, but when you entered the working force, you could maybe stay in the same job for 40 years and retire with benefits. And the new economy means there's going to be more disruption and that we need to find a way to kind of change our mindset and get used to that. And it's harder if you're 45 or 50 or 55.
Definitely.
But college students now know it may not be a 40 or 45 year career in the same place to the same company. Is that fair? Yes?
Absolutely. Yes.
There's another thing that we struggle with historically that makes it hard to have this conversation, and that is that often our context, particularly, you know, someone my age, I'm 61, someone my age, you look into the past and you say, well, boy, the glory days of the American economy back in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, all of which were dramatically influenced by World War II. In World War II, the entire world got together and completely destroyed the industrial plant of almost all the world except for the United States.
Yes.
And we invested in the United States in big ways. So by the end of the 1940s, we dominated the world. We had all the capital. We had all of the newest equipment. And as a consequence, our workers made a tremendous amount of money without any skills. So the thought that you can make a fabulous income, I mean, by world standards, without any skills at all, was really an unusual period in American history. And so, you know, the rest of the world started playing catch up in the 1960s and 70s, and it still hurts.
All right, Tim in Pittsburgh, next up. Go ahead, Tim.
First, I'm insulted that I wasn't consulted for the show. I got a solid B- in macroeconomics 16 years ago. So I'm
good for you.
But that aside, you know, Bernard's call about living in some sort of utopian society where money doesn't really matter, I understand it, but you go a half mile from your studio right now and you give that person $20, and they are going to be really, really happy because they're not sure how to feed themselves or their family through the end of the day. So, you know, I always take exception to people saying, well, money's not a big deal as long as you're happy. It's easy to save when you have money. But when you don't have money, it makes you really happy to have it and that you can just get from day to day to day. That aside, what happens, I've asked this and never got a clear answer. We had a former assemblyman on last year, and I said, you know, taxes are killing us here. Whether it's what comes out of your paycheck or what goes your county taxes, state taxes, property taxes, it's not like all of a sudden I'm going to wake up tomorrow, someone's going to pass law, and my taxes all of a sudden dropped $3,000 on my property, or 28% is not coming out of my paycheck and 15% is coming out of my paycheck in a middle-class family. I mean, what people bring up, you know, things to do, but am I ever going to see the effects of that more than maybe having my taxes cut, what, 1-2% maybe?
Tim, thanks for the phone call. Kent, Amit, maybe a little bit more localized policy than you're used to, but what do you think?
Well, I think, you know, cutting taxes, you know, I think the promise of some politicians that we can, you know, wave a magic wand and make a huge difference in our tax burden is a false promise. And that's probably kind of where you started this whole thing, Evan. You know, we got politicians out there who are making wild, outlandish promises that they can't fulfill. And, you know, unfortunately, some of us believe them.
But Tim might say, well, why can't somebody fulfill that?
Well, you know, you have to disentangle. You think about property taxes, for example. Let's disentangle what we're paying for. You know, what kind of services we're getting on our property taxes. You know, what in the public schools do you want to cut back? I mean, the vast majority of our property taxes go to public education. So, you know, are we going to change how we deliver educational services to individuals with special needs? That's where a lot of the money goes. Are we going to cut the salaries and benefits of teachers? Are we going to eliminate retiree health plan for retired teachers? I mean, you know, it gets really granular, very specific.
Yeah, and it's difficult, but I would urge the caller to keep one thing in mind. I mean, I grew up in a developing country and came to the United States when I was 18 years old. Relative to many other countries of the world, the taxes that we pay do get us a whole slew of services which we typically take for granted. If you've lived in other countries, certainly other developing countries, what tends to happen often is that you pay taxes yet get nothing in return. That's not the case in a country like the United States and in certainly many other countries in the Western world. You pay taxes, you do get a whole host of services alongside with it. But in addition to that, the question of what should the appropriate tax rate or what should the economic incentives be so that the middle class thrives in the United States is a very difficult question to answer because it involves getting a whole host of policies right, only one aspect of which is the appropriate tax rate.
Emily writes to us and says, if trade is this complicated, then maybe we should step back from these arrangements. I think most Americans support the idea of entering trade deals if it means improving the living standard of others around the world. But the truth is that we still see workers around the world living in poverty, working slave hours while companies pollute the environment, and a sliver of the business owners making a fortune. So what are we trading for? That's from Emily.
Well, who wants?
Okay. Yeah. So let me take a stab at
it. Go ahead, Professor.
Yeah. Okay. So the fact of the matter is, trade has benefited large numbers of people throughout the world. Particularly the more globalized and free trade regime in which we currently live has lifted vast numbers of people, particularly in developing countries such as India and China, out of poverty relative to where they were before the onset of globalization. There is no question about that. However, that or stories of that sort typically don't make as much news as sweatshops or horrendous treatment of laborers in, you know, country A or country B, take your pick. So it's important to not lose sight of the fact that there have been significant positive advantages in terms of lifting large numbers of people above poverty lines in many countries of the world. But the issue in the United States is more nuanced because some group of workers have lost out in a big way, and these workers are now really looming large in the political imagination of a lot of candidates, not the least of which is Donald Trump, and that needs to be addressed here.
Yeah, absolutely agree. And that, you know, your first point, I think, is just so important. The number of people who have been raised out of absolute poverty worldwide is stunning. I've forgotten the latest statistics, but the World Bank and the United Nations have documented the share of the world that lives below, I think, a dollar a day. And those numbers have changed radically.
Right.
You know, we have seen such a tremendous increase in the quality quality of life for so much of the world. And in the United States, you know, I think this is maybe not a very popular suggestion, but I think if all you need to do is to walk through Walmart to ask whether we as consumers have benefited from global trade. Perhaps, there's an argument we could have a conversation about whether we would like all that clothing made in the United States, but it would cost twice as much if it was.
But maybe we should pay more for clothing.
I'm not saying we shouldn't. But at the same time, if you're looking for the benefits of trade, You need go no further than to take a look at what we buy in terms of consumer goods.
Sure. And listeners, I would recommend that Planet Money did a video series on making a shirt in both Colombia and Bangladesh, and of course that's the country that had the factory collapse, about 1,000 people died, and you had this juxtaposition of mostly women, but people creating garments in relatively poor conditions, not being paid much, and then they tell you, these are some of the best paying jobs in that town. So it's not always as simple as saying, I'll never buy a garment from this place, etc. It is complicated, it's difficult. So I think, I agree, Emily, it is complicated, and we all wish it were overly simplified, but that's what political campaigns are for.
Evan, can I make one point?
Yes, sorry. Go ahead.
One problem that I do foresee, and this is a point where Donald Trump is right, is that a lot of our trade with China, one simple fact tends to get obscured, and that fact is that American firms don't have equal access or access into Chinese markets to the extent that the Chinese have access in the United States. There are reams of paperwork, bureaucratic snafus and delays, advantages given to local firms which prevent American firms from competing on a level footing. And that's a key problem in terms of
trade with China. It's not the allegedly misaligned exchange rate. That was the case 5 or 6 years ago, but it isn't.
Trump says we're losing $500 billion a year to China.
That's just not true. I think the number right, yeah, in fact, because I looked at it before I came here, I think the number right now is $305 billion.
Yeah, the interesting part about that is, you know, this is this conversation that that we've had about truthiness, you know, the interesting point is that he's right that there is a trade imbalance. What is so common with Trump is his numbers are so wildly off. Those of us who actually care about precision, you know, makes us crazy.
Should we desire a trade balance with China? Is that even achievable?
Is it achievable? I mean, in principle, yes, but that's not something that we should be aspiring to.
Yeah,
we should let market forces do the job. And it is true that we import a lot more from them than we export to them. That's true. But that statistic in and of itself does not mean that, you know, calamity is about to strike us tomorrow.
That's right. And to a large extent, they're lending us money, basically, to buy their stuff. I mean, there are some financial advantages of having a trade imbalance. And, you know, the United States, just partly because of the strength of our currency and the strength of our economy, disproportionately benefits from trade.
Okay. And it's important to remember that Donald Trump has mastered one art very well. It's often not what you say, it's how you say it.
Yeah, forget the content.
Well, and the strength of our currency. Don't worry, Kent. We'll all have Bitcoin soon enough.
Perhaps so.
cryptocurrency, which is the subject for another hour here. So just some final thoughts here. Amit, 30 seconds each. Kent, you want to leave the audience with something to keep in mind about trade. You can't really simplify it in 30 seconds, I understand. But what's right. Something to keep in mind when you hear all the rhetoric that's flying?
The thing that I would urge your listeners to keep in mind about trade is that it does benefit countries in the aggregate. However, when you're voting and whoever it is that you're voting for, think about the following, that some of our citizens, particularly those in manufacturing, are hurting big time, and we do need to put in place policies so that these people are helped in some way, particularly since they're not being afforded the assistance right now.
But ripping up trade deals isn't necessarily the best way
Absolutely
to help.
Absolutely not.
Okay, Kent.
Yeah, I think effective and communication about trade deals is important but difficult. I think we have to recognize that the benefits and talk more about how the benefits of trade have changed our way of life in dramatic ways, in dramatic positive ways. And we just have to make sure that we focus on ways in which we soften the blow to the people who are disadvantaged.
We could have taken calls all day on this. And a lot of the calls came late. I think a lot of our audience was really trying to soak it in and listen. So I'll just say that if you kind of called in toward the end of the hour and didn't get through, Kent and Amit are very generous with their time, and I suspect we'll be able to lure them back here, because my guess is over the next 8 months or so, you may hear more rhetoric about trade.
Just maybe.
Absolutely.
Professor Amit Badabiel from RIT, great to have you. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Kent Gardner from the Center for Governmental Research. As always, Kent, thank you.
Thank you, Evan.
And thank you, listeners, providing a lot of good material for us to work with. And I, as a host, I need to go back and take an econ course anyway. Maybe Tim and I will go back. We'll see if we can improve on our B-. Thanks, Val Labanca. Thank you, Marielle Brinkerhoff, who was wonderful on the phones today, and Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. We'll talk to you Thursday.